Directions PaizoCon 2015 coverage. We con when you can't. Warning, these are live and unedited recordings of the PaizoCon 2015 seminars. If the seminar contains audience participation, it may be difficult to understand some of the audio. Also be warned, these seminars may contain cheeky language.
All right, score. Ready? Ready! All right, please. Hi, everybody. This is the seminar that is all about occultism. The big book that Paizo is releasing for the Pathfinder role-playing game this summer is Occult Adventures. And we've got two seminars about that over the next 2 hours. This is the first. We're going to be talking today here primarily about some of the thematic inspirations for the book and some of just the whole like content in terms of the flavor and stuff like that.
Right.
And then the next seminar, which starts in an hour, is going to be a little bit more mechanics focused. The rules team is going to come in that as well. So before everyone leaves, I'll introduce myself. I'm Eric Mona. I am the publisher and chief creative officer at Paizo. The whole occult adventures thing was my idea, basically. Brandon, why don't you explain who you are and your role with
that? I'm Brandon Hodge. I'm one of Paizo's freelancers. I'm one of their adventure jockeys, mostly on the Adventure Path line. For this particular project, I guess 3 years ago now, Eric approached me with this idea he had for occult adventures. The reason I got that approach is because I have traveled the world documenting and researching spirit communication devices for about the last decade or so. I'm one of the world-recognized authorities on the subject, and it just fit right in with not only a lot of the freelancing that I was doing, but also with some of the specific themes that he wanted to play with in this. Most of that work, that other side of what I do, is on my website, mysteriousplanchette.com, which is sort of my public outlet for all that stuff. So have fun with that.
So even though I don't want to focus that much on mechanics in this presentation, it's important to at least explain, I think, the background in some sense of what occult adventures is going to be. When we sort of looked at all the different rules that had been presented in the D20 third edition's system before and what we had done in Pathfinder, one of the things that we had not gotten to that people have been asking us for a lot was psionics rules. Psionics has been a part of tabletop gaming since almost the beginning, and it was something that we really wanted to be very, very careful about. I, as the publisher and the guy who decides what books we do, have always been very, very leery of Pathfinder just, for example, taking what D&D has done in the past and just copying it every time. You know, let's do a player's handbook and a dungeon master's guide and a monster manual and a Oriental Adventures and a planar handbook. You know, there's the same eight books kind of got done every edition, and I really wanted to create something new with Pathfinder, even though we use the same similar rules for as a basis for it. And so one of the things I didn't want to do was copy the psionics rules verbatim, and there was a couple of reasons for that. One reason is there's a company called Dreamscarred Press, who you guys might know. They do a book called Ultimate Psionics. We really like that book. They do a great job with the third edition psionics rules. That said, no one at Paizo really loves the third edition psionics rules. So like, I can acknowledge that those guys do a great job. In fact, they do a much better job than we could do because we don't have the passion for, you know, points-based systems and the kind of, I guess what I sort of think of as a more techie approach to psionics. In fact, one of my concerns was that, two concerns rules-wise. I really didn't like the idea that in order to have mind-casting, you know, psychic powers, you also had to learn like a second whole spellcasting system to graft onto a book that was already 600 pages long. That I think was one of the reasons why Sonics has never really been fully embraced, is it's a whole pile of brand new rules paradigm that you have to learn. The other thing is, you know, psionics throughout D&D's history had been really inspired by like science fiction novels of the 50s, by some of the stuff going on in the science fiction pulps and things like that. Even the word psionics sort of conjures like ideas of science fiction. In fact, when we started talking about doing occult adventures and we said there's going to be psychic rules in there, a lot of people were like, well, I don't use sci-fi. And I'm thinking, well, that's great because we're not trying to do sci-fi. We're going to do something different. And so one of the things that I have been particularly interested in for many, many years is kind of some of the real world, if you will, occults inspirations that underlie, you know, sword and sorcery fiction, Dungeons and Dragons, Pathfinder, stuff like that, trying to kind of figure out what the real story behind some of these nouns that are just sort of incorporated into the game. Brandon has been a friend and a freelancer for quite some time, and in particular around the time the idea for Occult Adventures was gelling, Brandon was hard at work on the Rasputin Must Die adventure for Reign of Winter. And in that, you had done the Spiritualists.
We did an occult oracle mystery. Right.
And so within the context of that, Brandon and I started sort of talking about not just games and things like that, but also we found that we both collect Ouija boards, for example. Mm-hmm. That's probably how it started. Mm-hmm. And then started sharing photographs of our book collections, and it, you know, was this weird internet bromance, I think, at that point.
Totally. Do you even a cult bra?
Yeah. So, so what we wanted to do was find a thematic route for a series of psychic rules and other sort of phenomena that go along with that that felt a little bit more rooted in a fantasy tradition than in a science fiction tradition. And that's the reason why we're calling it psychic magic and not psionics. That's the reason why the mechanics of psychic magic largely work like the mechanics of normal spells. In fact, they're called spells. That's the reason why we brought Brandon, preeminent expert in his field, into the project to kind of get his ideas and really kind of evaluation of some of our ideas and make sure we're kind of on the right track.
Well, we had a hurdle to jump to, which was really interesting. So much of this has already been co-opted. You can already cast Detect Thoughts as a first level sorcerer, for instance, or is that a second level spell? But you get what I mean. So much of this has been co-opted, you know, starting with first edition and onward. And how do you reclaim that territory, that thematic territory, when it's already out there? You already have astral projection and all that. So that was a big hurdle this book had to overcome, was how can we do this without skewing the power scale or you know, messing up the tools we already had to play with, and how do those elements fit in with this revision and how it's going to go down. So
right. So I think one of the things that started it, once Brandon agreed to participate in the project, I just by happenstance, for another work reason, was visiting Austin, where Brandon lives, and we sat down for about 2 or 3 days and just like brainstormed the hell out of I have the sheet of paper that quite frankly looks like one of the diaries from the movie Seven, you know, it's just like my like crazy scrawls, you know. I remember, it was funny, just as an aside, you know, I get into town and Brandon's like, yeah, let's hang out, but I hope it's not a problem, but you know, on Saturday morning I've got to go run D&D yoga.
That's right.
And so I'm like, D&D yoga, first of all, that's a cult. And second of all, I'm like, okay, cool. Like, I'll just sit and watch as Brandon ran this amazing, like, adventure with all these people doing, like, downward dog and stuff, you know, and it was great. And
downward goblin dog.
Yeah, right. And I'm sitting there in the corner like a madman, like, okay, how about teleporting objects, and what about like ectoplasm, you know, and made this big long list, and we sort of compared notes, and that eventually sort of became the outline to some degree for Occult Adventures. But before I get into that all stuff, Brandon, I've got a question for you.
All right.
As the world, if not the world's preeminent expert, certainly the room's preeminent expert, what do we mean by occultism? What does that mean?
Well, first of all, I'll clarify, I'm not the world's preeminent expert on occultism.
I understand that.
I've got a kind of specialized view. Spirit communication devices is really my forte and what inspires my worldly endeavors, but occultism, that which is unseen. Do you want to start there? Because
sure.
That certainly is a theme that threads its way throughout this. In fact, I know we're here to talk about occult adventures, but we've announced it. I could talk about this freely. So, House on Hook Street, you might have seen, was announced on Paizo.com. That is actually the accompanying adventure for Occult Adventures. So I'm going to use that sort of as a crutch to talk about how you can incorporate this in your game. Because what you're going to see in that adventure, and there's enough hints online already, is that we're going to apply the themes and everything we play with in this book, and we take old Corvosa in the aftermath of what all the events that we know took place in there through Curse of the Crimson Throne. And we say, all right, you know, you have Occult Adventures, you know, we're a little bit in the future here, but you have Occult Adventures, you've read this, what, you know, you've read the Running an Occult Campaign. What does it mean? How does that apply? And that adventure is really going to open up. What are these unseen paths, which is what I'm getting back around to? These unseen ways of thinking. How does the world work? What are these other precepts of reality and belief? And that adventure is really going to take a lot of what we're talking about here and what's going to show up in Occult Adventures and show you how it works in Galarian, why, how these paths are walked there, and the results that it has. And sort of take that little blueprint, you can take Old Corvosa and kind of clone stamp it elsewhere in your home campaigns or whatever. So the unseen path, why don't you talk about some of those who walk the unseen path?
Well, I mean, so Brandon's sort of specialty is the you know, spiritualist devices and things
right.
like that. I would say that the area of my expertise, if you can call it that, is I'm very interested in 19th century, primarily 19th century quasi-religious movement called Theosophical Society, which is actually still around. This was
they're listening.
Are there any theosophists
they are.
Here? they are not what they once were. But at one time, they were huge, and they had chapters all around the world. It was an attempt to divine sort of the ultimate truth underneath all world religions. And so it was also happening in the late 19th century, so it was happening within the context of, like, Darwinism and evolution and things like that. So there's a whole lot of stuff about the evolution of the soul, about evolution of mankind into sort of post-human angelic beings and things like that. And as a big, big part of that... is the idea of reincarnation and the idea of past lives and projecting one's mind through the astral plane to read something called the Akashic Record, which is a perfect record of everything that has ever happened. And there were occultists associated with theosophy, the most primary one being H.P. Blavatsky, Madame Blavatsky, who is probably the most famous occultist of the 19th, 20th century, early 20th century. And one of the guys who followed her up in the organization is a guy called C.W. Leadbeater, who's like probably my favorite occultist, except that he's not a good person at all.
Not a good person.
Very fascinating guy. Very inspirational, always surrounded himself with coteries of young boys. We won't go further than that, but the theosophists became obsessed with sort of how their past lives intermixed with each other. Like if you have someone who, say, you're married with or who you're close with, why are you close to that person? And Leadbeater would be able to show that, well, by going... casting his mind into the Akashic Record and saying, oh, well, Brandon, the reason we get along is that in ancient Chaldea, we were buddies, or, you know. And so it all tied in, right, and it all tied in with the idea of reincarnation, too, which is rooted in Hinduism. And the idea of the evolution of a human soul is enriched through experience. And so the belief is that you reincarnate not just... if you're a man, you might reincarnate as a woman, you might reincarnate as a variety of different, you know, races and backgrounds and things like that. And it's only by experiencing sort of the totality of human experience through various cycles of reincarnation that you can move on to sort of the next step.
Now, Eric,
is
deep.
Brandon.
That is deep.
Sorry.
I would love to roll up a character exploring these themes. What does Occult Adventures offer me that's going to... condense all that mishmash into something I can use at the game table?
Well, I think that's a great question, Brandon.
I thought you would.
We've already tinkered a little bit with reincarnation in the form of a race called the Samsarans, who we introduced in the Dragon Empires stuff, and that is a reincarnating race that is aware of its previous reincarnations. We touch on that a little bit in Occult Adventures, not really much in Occult Adventures, but in some of the follow-up products. Like we just announced a product called Occult Realms, which is tying in the occult stuff from Occult Adventures into specific locations and things within the context of Galarian itself. So there's a lot about Samsarans in there. We also, I wrote a few sections of the book myself, and one of those was a section called the Esoteric Planes. So to backtrack just a little bit and be more pedantic than answering it straight, which in and of itself is pretty close to occultism, you know, just why go straight to something when you can beat around the bush? There were a couple of nouns in AD&D that I never understood as a kid. I never really understood what the astral plane and the ethereal plane were supposed to be about. Even after reading several books throughout first edition, it was like, so it's a foggy place where nothing happens? Okay, I get it. And I knew there had to be more to it than that. And then there was another noun that I never really understood, which was the monadic diva. So there's a diva, it's like an angel character, a monster in D&D and in Pathfinder, and it's called monadic diva, but I never really understood what monadic meant, right? And it was never really explained. Well, monadic is tied in to the soul. The soul is a monad, that is the thing that persists throughout your different reincarnations, sort of your ultimate soul. And so that's where that's from. And as I looked deeper and deeper into it, I learned that the ethereal plane and the astral plane, a lot of that stuff was either original to or really was popularized by the Theosophical Society. It's really hard to imagine that, like, Gary Gygax didn't have some knowledge of this stuff when he was building the outer planes. The whole idea of outer planes, in some sense, is tied into a lot of this as well. So I wrote the section on the esoteric planes, and what the esoteric planes are is it's not the outer planes. The outer planes in the Pathfinder cosmology is what happens largely after you've died and your soul has gone on to, like, its final reward. That the esoteric planes are the material plane, the ethereal plane, the astral plane, the positive and negative energy planes. So essentially, it was amazing to me because as I was putting this thing together, I was gathering everything we'd ever said about the let's say the positive energy plane, right? One of the things that we said was that the positive energy plane is a source of life energy in the multiverse, and that life energy is connected and is infused into the material plane via gates within the hearts of stars. And it's through those stars that life energy kind of emanates throughout the material plane. And when I read that, I was like, oh my God, I don't know if it was a coincidence or not, but that is basically the concept of theosophy, essentially, right? that there is a vast storehouse of spiritual soul energy that is emanated from the sun. It might be called prana, it might be called odic force, or all kinds of different things. And that is what gives us animating life energy. And so I kind of tied some stuff like that into the overall esoteric planes. I put the Akashic Record officially into the world as a demiplane in the astral plane. We also talk a lot about the dimension of dreams, being the most occult experience we probably have ourselves every night. Right. And so there's quite a lot of information about those planes that come from sort of the esoteric tradition.
And talking about that mysterious unknown force with a million names, Anton Mesmer is the gentleman, the occultist from whom we get the term mesmerism, modern hypnotism, from. And the belief that he's proposing is that there is a eternally binding force that penetrates all living and non-living matter and that can be manipulated. Kind of makes him the Yoda of the occult world. And man, I wish I had my slides, because I've got a great little Mesmer with his powdered wig and Yoda's face.
Oh, nice.
On my
slides.
Yeah. Next year.
Try to imagine that.
Yeah, imagine powdered wig on Yoda. Very funny. You'd all be laughing. And so we're going to have a class in Occult Adventures that's actually straight up going to be able to manipulate that force, as it were. And yes, this is the same force that George Lucas is going to draw on for his force.
Right.
The mental manipulations we see, you know, Obi-Wan doing with the stormtroopers is a good example of the sorts of thing the mesmerist is going to, he's controlling these, we call magnetic fluids, animal magnetism, this pervasive thing, Vril. Deep magic goes into...
Well, even telekinesis sort of plays into this,
right,
well, by manipulating this force that's all around us. I mean, it is amazing.
And these are the sorts of things we're breaking down as we're trying... You know, we're really, at this point, Eric and I are in this conversation are still in the kind of conversation we were having in Austin, you know, trying to get to what's going to be in the book, you know, talking about, you know, here's what the real world belief was, but how do we get there?
Right, and then, you know, there was another element too, which is I think that there's a sort of... When I started the project, I had this really strong sense that there was like a real difference between, I guess, what I would call 19th century occultism, which is, you know, some of the spiritualism, some of the Theosophical Society, psychic phenomena, stuff like that, and like the New Age, you know, what kind of became the New Age movement. I grew up in the 80s, and I remember like my mom going to the New Age bookstore, and it was all like pastel colors and stuff about breathing through your forehead and all that crap. You know, and I always sort of felt like somewhere it took a turn for the worse, you know. And so I knew that there were another section that I wrote of the book focuses on chakras and auras, right? Which you can't get much more New Agey than that. But that stuff has a tradition through Hinduism that goes back, you know, thousands and thousands of years. And so I wanted to get a sense of like what the real world underpinnings of that stuff was, so that I could more faithfully translate that into the Pathfinder role-playing game in a way that wasn't so 80s New Age bookstore hokey, but that kind of resonated with what we're doing. So I wrote, for example, about auras. And oh my God, what are you wearing, Brandon? What is that?
What color do you think you look like right now?
I don't know. I hope I'm a resplendent.
This is a pair of 1940s aura goggles. For my collection. Now, fun fact about aura goggles, actually me asking Eric what color he thinks I see him in is incorrect. It's a common misnomer that aura goggles are used to train your aura sight, not used to view auras in others. What I'm seeing here is very vague shapes. The lights are sort of echoing up here. And they're very thick, opaque, purple lenses. What this does ideally is wearing them for a time when you take them off, your eyes will be properly trained. So after viewing through this Kilna screen, you can then see auras emanating from around people. Now, I didn't wear those very long. But you can imagine if you put these on for a little while that your vision might go a little bit fuzzy. And, So what you're going to find is, unlike other aura goggles at other game systems that didn't quite know these fun facts the way that Eric and I do, the aura goggles you'll find in Occult Adventures you do not wear in view. You put them on to train your eyes, and then it gives you bonuses to aura viewing when you remove them. So I'm going to pass these around, and feel free to look through them. There, just it's kind of thick purple Kilna screen. So have fun with those.
So auras within the context of Pathfinder, you know, it's like, okay, so what's the point? You know, great. So you have a green aura. What does that mean exactly? So one of the things that we had to do is there's already rules for auras in Pathfinder, but they're not anything about emotions. They're not anything really about people. They're more like, okay, is something magical? It has a magical aura, you know? And so what I was able to do is by reading up on auras in the real world, if you will, I learned that auras are composed of a number of different parts. There's a health aura, which is that life energy radiating from within that goes out about 3 feet. And that maintains the health of the body. It is, in fact, according to the occult tradition, that life energy, which is often called prana, that like holds the body together. So it's when you die and that energy goes away, that's why you start to rot, and that's why everything falls apart. Take it or leave it, you know, that's the
story.
Starts
at 40.
Both Brandon and I turned 40 like within the last 3 weeks, so our prana has never been worse.
It's leaking out of me.
Yeah. So there is a guide in Occult Adventures to what the different colors are, how you can view auras, which is interesting in that, again, don't want to get too mechanical, but we introduce the concept of occult skill unlocks, so you can use skills that you already have to gain occult powers, basically.
Right.
So is it, heal or is it perception? It's perception.
Perception for aura reading.
So there's skill unlock,
right.
And skill unlocks were introduced in Pathfinder Unchained.
Fun fact, I wrote the skill unlocks for Occult Adventures. I was utterly unaware of that skill unlocks were on the way with Unchained. I wrote them totally, and turns out I wrote them right because we didn't have to change anything.
Yeah.
So great idea, Brandon.
So if you're a member of an occult class, which are any of the six classes in Occult Adventures, Or if you have the psychic sensitive feats, you can unlock these special powers based on the normal skills. So perception is aura reading.
Mm-hmm. There's faith healing.
Heal is faith healing. Psychometry is in there. Is it a praise?
Automatic psychometry is a praise. Right. Automatic writing is there.
Survival. Mm-hmm. We'll get to questions in just a bit here. So there's a color thing that basically says, okay, if the aura is this color, that means the person's being duplicitous, or it means the person's in love, or whatever. And you can use that to kind of enhance the story and to gain a little bit more information. There's also spells in the book that allow you to trace the resonant auras of people who have departed from a place, like they've left behind. You're basically shedding this prana energy the whole time, and so you can leave some of it behind, and people can learn information from what you've left behind, and they can follow you.
Well, and it's also going to shed light again on, how does detect evil work?
Right.
How does detect alignment work or no alignment work? Now we had the mechanism. Now you know the real story. Now you know how we got there.
Read the book.
Read the book.
Yeah. So that's one of the things I worked on. Chakras, I won't get too into, but it's another kind of New Age concept that I tried to implement in a way that that allows particularly ki using characters, because ki is another word for this life energy, to channel their life energy through the various chakras in their body, and as they spend ki to open up these different swirling vortices of life energy, they get different powers associated with, maybe the heart chakra is about emotion, and maybe the throat chakra is about communication and stuff like that. You can gain special powers by funneling your ki energy through the chakras. So, Brandon, you've got a big box of goodies.
I do.
One of the things that is really cool about Occult Adventures, I think, is it's got a really robust section of equipment and magic items that are inspired in large part from sort of real world occult items. Right. And Brandon, actually, it's crazy because he owns a whole bunch of them. So I'd be like, Brandon, have you ever heard of this crazy item? And he's like, you mean this thing that I'm wearing on my head? And it's like, okay, great. Well, not anymore. Someone else is wearing Brandon's goggles. One thing actually, I should show him this little thing here before we get into your stuff.
No, let's talk about the spiritualism a little bit, because it's so Eric's specialty is theosophy. Mine is spiritualism. American spiritualism gets its start. I mean, this isn't strictly a belief in ghosts and spirits. That's obviously goes much further back in mankind's history. But in 1848. Some of you may or may not be familiar. I'll just give you the brief outline here. The Fox sisters, Kate and Maggie Fox, they're teenagers. They're hearing unusual noises in their Hydesville, New York home. And they establish communication. This is the important part of the story. They're hearing all these strange knockings and, weird movements in their home. And they actually challenge these noises to communicate with them. And they do answer back, do what I do. I snap my fingers 3 times. The spirits knock back 3 times. That moment, why that's so important is again, it's not that it brings about a belief in spirits or ghosts, but that it opens up the idea that that we can tap into those other planes that we call the ethereal and the astral in these books. And that we can breach communication with the other side. What that's going to trigger, that initial binary communication, tap once for yes, tap twice for no, it's going to trigger just a smorgasbord of ways to communicate with the dead. And that's really my specialty. Some of the earliest stuff, in 1853, we're going to experience table tipping. I would love to have had a table tipping event at this. And now, in retrospect, I probably should have thought about that a little bit sooner. Table tipping is you need a medium initially to communicate with the spirits. You go to someone who's sensitive enough to communicate. They can hear the spirits. The knocks seem to follow them. That's not suspicious at all. But you hire a medium. You go to a seance, and you sit in at the time, a bright room. It was not dark. And you ask questions of the spirits, and you get responses back. You can perform something called alphabet calling. You call out the alphabet, A, B, C, D, E, F, G, F. Okay, F, write that down. A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, you know, and so forth. This could be rather tedious. In fact, Reverend Mattinson in 1854 does experiments communicating messages and communicate 240 characters per hour. That's less than two tweets. So you can imagine what all these Victorians were doing in these seance rooms when they weren't grabbing one another's wives, getting these long and laborious communications. So this has to be refined. And this is what's going to lead to the explosion. Table tipping for one in 1853. You can call out and everybody puts their hand, not unlike, you know, you're familiar with the movement of the planchette on the Ouija board. You can put your hands on the table and the table will begin to tip and rap and knock out. People begin discovering this in the early 1850s. With that discovery of this ideomotor response or spiritual influence, depending on what your belief is, it is discovered that, a few things are discovered. One, we can write out the alphabet on a board and we can just point to the letters and try to expedite this alphabetic communication. We get real close. They actually start putting letters on boards like this, but we don't have Ouija boards yet. This is in 1850, and this is as far as they get. They're just pointing to the letters. They don't have the automatic movement that's going to come along. That is going to come along with this device. This is an automatic writing planchette. Another one, but it's so much older and nicer. In 1853, June 10th, Alan Kardec devises the automatic writing planchette, or reports on the invention of the automatic writing planchette. This is an early 1850 specimen. This is going to take advantage of the same type of movement that you're used to seeing, that people are already used to doing with the table, the rapping and the knocking and the movement of the table. Only you're going to put it on this small board. You'll see it's got two wheels there on the bottom, and your third wheel is a pencil that goes in right here, and you're going to put that on the tabletop. And it's going to, everyone puts their hands on it, it begins to mysteriously move and write and spell out messages. This is an exceptionally rare piece here. Put that there, and y'all can go up here and look at that in a bit. But we're still not going to get to talking boards yet. We've got some other examples. These are going to explode in the UK and Britain. You're going to get magic item stats for these. They're going to be accurate this time, I promise. There's a Selkow and Ryder from 1880. Then also in 1853, you're going to get the spirit trumpet. A really fascinating event takes place in Ohio, the Coombs Spirit Room. Jonathan and Nim Coombs, remember that name. You're going to see it again in the house on Hook Street. Nim Coombs, what they do is really give us our modern conception of the seance. They're going to turn off the lights for the first time. When you go to the Coombs farmhouse, they've got this little, you know, 12 by 14 shack in their backyard, and like 20 people go in there, they shut off the lights, and ectoplasmic manifestations begin to appear. And these quiet whispers float around the room. The violins are seized and float around the room, wielded by ghostly hands. This is all going to be very important in occult adventures. It's very important to our history. And the means of communication in that room are actually the spirit trumpet, a very light beaten tin or aluminum little pressed jobber here. And this is used to communicate the voices of spirits that were able to, very kind of feebly, I say they don't have the ectoplasmic fortitude to totally channel and possess through you. They have to whisper. It also helps that whispering helps you disguise the source of your voice, but what do I know? So this is your spirit trumpet. I'm going to pass this around too. It's pretty sturdy, but do please be careful. So I'm a medium. I'm at a table. We sing some hymns, we turn out the lights, and what you'll see through this little luminous band right here is typically in a seance, everybody chains their hands, right? So you form a little chain. So my hands as the medium are bound. Any magicians that'll crucify me if I give away the secret in the room? No? All right, cool. So Eric, would you grab my left wrist, please? All right.
He's not moving that wrist.
So, right, he's not moving that wrist. Would you step forward here? We'll have a little fun. I'm going to grab your wrist. So, and we're going to form a big chain around this table, just like we would do. So the lights are out, the hymns are going, and the spirits have got me moving. And what's going to happen is, if you were actually sitting next to me, is I'm eventually going to work this and then do this. I don't want to say I have a free hand now. He thinks I still have his wrist. Eric still thinks he's got my wrist. If I really get crafty and I'm really good at it, I can get this going on. Oh. Now I'm free and clear to do whatever I want. So what you see is suddenly the trumpets ring in the pitch blackness is floating around the room and mysterious voices are getting whispered into your ear. Thank you, gentlemen. So that is how the spirit trumpet largely would be used.
Speak into the medium speaks into
right,
the
right. And actually, there's some contention about whether you speak this way or this way. It actually is easier this way for the medium. So, yeah, this is from the 1900s, so have fun passing that around.
And spirit trumpets are in Occult Adventures.
Also in Occult Adventures, yeah. In the case of the magic item, you can they can either enhance your channeling or you can put them to the lips of a corpse. It will speak for you. So, another means of writing spirit slates, another item that's going to appear. This is going to be used to collect spirit writing, again, kind of with the same sort of technique. Again, if you're a skeptic, I don't want to step on anyone's beliefs here, but the spirit slate would collect spirit writing. Usually you'd mark a big X. You'd have somebody mark a big X, and then the writing would appear over it, so you could see it was genuine and not pre-prepared. Spoiler, the spirit slate in Occult Adventures works with a finger bone or a scrap of bone from a deceased creature. It's got to have effects answering questions very similar to Blood Script spell, which is one of my favorites. So, that's a spirit slate. It's a school slate, so you probably recognize that from history class.
Is there any difference between a school slate and
No, there's not. Now, there are gaffed slates that magicians would use, but you largely find in history that the spook show magicians that come along trying to expose all this stuff typically make up all these crazy methods for how it could be done when a good medium just needed a dark room and full of believers. But they are going to come up with all kinds of crazy methods for how these slates are gaffed and rigged, and those are fascinating in their own right, but a typical spirit medium just needed to get their arm loose. Eventually, we will make our way toward Ouija boards. In the 1890s, I brought along one of the originals. This is an 1890 Kennard Ouija board from the Kennard Novelty Company. And it's a funky little paddle-shaped planchette, which I'm going to set up. You'll find the rules for these in Occult Adventures as well. What I'm really getting at, what I really want to talk about, Eric, before I turn it over to you, is ectoplasm. Because ectoplasm was the thing in my heart as consultant on this book that we just had to get right. And what you're going to find about ectoplasm, because, you know, we're all familiar with Ghostbusters, and he slimed me. It's just all the smelly goo. The conception of ectoplasm is actually very close to our D&D, or our Pathfinder cosmology, if you were. And that is, it's the fabric, the veil between the border of the material plane and the ethereal plane. And a medium, or in our case, for class definitions, a spiritualist, is actually, the conception was, is that you would sort of channel this ethereal boundary through your own body. And you'd actually lose weight. You'd kind of contribute your own mucus membranes and body moisture to this, and it would collect with this. And you would actually ooze ectoplasm out of your pores, your eyes, your nose, your mouth. And it would basically form this veil that the spirit would then step through. So the spirit has no physical form, and instead drapes itself in a curtain of ectoplasm, which is this, you know, sort of pudding film, if you will, on the ethereal plane. And that's the conception that is going to translate into how all of this works in Occult Adventures. The spiritualist actually is doing that. So unlike the summoner, who's creating these creatures and, you know, bringing them in from other planes, you're drawing the soul of a creature through this curtain. And while it's here, it's tied to you through the curtain that you've produced. So that's how the spiritualist works.
So some of you probably has anyone seen the spiritualist iconic character? Do you guys know what that looks like? We'll be revealing all the iconic characters for Occult Adventures in the preview banquet tomorrow night. Spiritualist is our first old woman iconic character. She's pretty awesome, and she is protected by the phantom of her her husband who died in battle. And so there is a young warrior ghost with a big slash right through his breastplate who's kind of standing over and protecting this elderly woman. And the idea there is, as Brandon just said, it's a spirit that kind of pushes its way into the material, cloaking itself in this ectoplasmic.
Yeah, we really got away from goo in this book. You know, right. Those of you, you know, Ghost Walk is very near and dear to my heart, but I was always hated that ectoplasm was just this goo stuff in there, and without any basis in, you know, in the cosmology and where this stuff really came from. And so this is going to, you know, provide that framework. And it infiltrates a lot more than we thought. The more we went into the book, you know, we don't just have ectoplasmic goo spell, you know, and stuff. We've got a lot of different ways we found that permeated into things.
So one of the things that that we did when we were particularly talking about the equipment and what magic items and things we would want to put into occult adventures is Brandon and I both have pretty decent-sized libraries of books and things about this. And one of the books that I acquired during the process of writing this book is this thing right here, which is the DeLawrence Catalog. This is actually, it's a little difficult to date, but I think this is from the early 60s. But the DeLawrence Catalogs go back, what was the first one? Do you have any idea?
Oh, gosh.
They've been going on forever. Do you want to talk a little bit about who DeLawrence was? You know that.
No.
He was a plagiarist, is what he was.
Yeah,
he was plagiarist. And an occult book publisher. And he would, I mean, this is a somewhat unique, it's a catalog, but, you know, this is a 12-page article on teachings of the ancients and mystic orders of music and just all this. You know, these were included largely as, like, samples of pages from his books. The DeLawrence books are gorgeous. I should have brought one of them. They're like grimoires.
Yeah.
They're huge. And they're filled with illustrations. They're really, really cool. And they'll be like the Manual of Talismanic Magic or like the Hindu Spirits and stuff like that. They're just amazing, amazing books. And in addition to this being a book catalog that includes a bunch of articles plagiarized from other books, this is also a catalog filled with little knickknacks and doodads and magic rings and amulets and all that kind of stuff. And it's very fragile, and I can't pass it around, but if you want to come up afterwards and take a look, I'm happy to show you. And we marked a couple of things, like, for example, Gabriel, please blow my horn.
Yes.
It's a full-page ad for a spirit trumpet, just like Brandon was talking about. As you get a little deeper into this book, there are lots and lots and lots of pages showing, you know, magical amulets and various different talismans that have weird engravings and different symbols of magical power. These things have always sort of been in the game, but not really. You know, I
mean, yeah. And Eric, so how much does one of those run?
Look at these little things here. How much does one of these run in
1962?
They were. That's a good question. It doesn't actually say. It just says, with orders for $15 or over, famous seals on parchment from the
city. Do you get one free with order?
I think you get one free with order.
That's not 62,000 gold pieces.
No, you're right. Yeah.
How can this power be mine?
Right? I think you could buy occult adventures, and we might give you low GP little luck talismans and things like that.
That's always bad. I mean, I know action economy can get to become. I mean, not action economy. Crafting economy can you know lead to a lot of arguments on message boards, and that's one thing we try to keep the occult. Although it scales all the way up, we tried to reclaim some of that territory where you know. You should be able to go to a hedge wizard and get a magic amulet that might do something. It might be a one use. We've got feather tokens, right? We've had those for years, so we decided we would do talismans. I've actually got a few up here that are available in the DeLawrence catalog. What does this one do? Look one up. Let me see.
While Brandon is looking up that talisman, I will just list off a couple of items that are in the book that I'm particularly pleased that we were able to sneak in. One of the things that you learn the more you look into this occultism stuff is that the Venn diagram of occultism and conspiracy theory is pretty overlappy. And so One of the things that we were very, very pleased to put in the outline and that was on, I think, one of the first lists that we did is, I'm pleased to say that Occult Adventures does include statistics for the tinfoil hat. So if you want to do that, you can do that. It's called the Tin Hat, I think. But then there's a super powerful version of it called the Stanic Crown. So that was really exciting. Let's see, what else is in the book that's really great? I mean, a lot of the items on the table here.
I think I've nailed it. Let's see. So we've got talisman number 18344. You feel like this ought to be able to do something for you here, people.
Hey, Brandon, that book was $300.
Yeah, you overpaid for this thing. This ancient talisman was taken from the Greater Key of Solomon. A curious inscription referring to it reads as follows: "The fifth and last pinnacle of Venus, when it is only showeth to any person soever, it inciteth and exciteth wonderfully unto love." Pretty that ought to be serious. Worth a plus one bonus on my diplomacy check, you think?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
Wow, look at that. That's fabulous.
Yeah, sorry.
So, yeah.
You can have that one.
Oh, that's
I don't know what it does. Ha ha, sucker. Oh. You took it willingly. Some other, this is a really neat thing. It kind of plays more into mesmerism here, the galvanic influence and such. Been really looking forward to showing these off. So these are galvanic battery talismans. Unfortunately, I discovered their existence only after we had done the turnover. This is actually a new thing I've been picking up. And these took early, battery theory, anyone familiar with the voltaic pile, it's just alternating bands of copper and zinc with an insulator and moisture. These take that same concept. They're alternating a little disc of copper and zinc, the idea being that your body sweat would actually activate them and it would charge your animal magnetism and grant you power. And these things were all the rage in the 1880s. I've got a few up here, so I brought those. Yeah, I'm really, really wishing I had known about these. These would totally be on the talisman list. But we did put magnetic paper, which will aid you in your automatic writing attempts.
That's right.
So.
That's right. Automatic writing is one of the skill unlocks as well. Mm-hmm. Well, we are at 4:46 here, so unless you've got more goodies you want to show off, Brandon,
I think it might make sense to open up for some
questions if some people are curious about some stuff. We'll start here.
So earlier you were mentioning about the esoteric planes, how it's positive, negative, ethereal, astral, and the material plane. How do the first world plane and the shadow plane fit into that?
They're sort of tangential to it, basically. They are sort in the same sense of like in the normal paradigm of like inner planes, outer planes, they fit within sort of that inner planes and the transitive planes area. But as they don't really have anything to do with the soul's transmigration after death, I didn't really include them. They're sort of like, oh, and those are there as well. And we'll do other stuff. Like I didn't really think it was that appropriate to be like, and now let's pause for 8 pages about fairies. Because it's not, they're there, but they're not really of the same sort of theme. And so Shadow and the First World don't play tremendously into the Occult Adventures. They're there, The esoteric planes are part of the whole Great Beyond. But that because all the planes that I mentioned in terms of the negative, the positive, the material, the astral, and the ethereal have to do with the soul and its journey, that was kind of the focus of the section. So they don't, really. We'll do more books on shadows and fairies and stuff, I promise. Yeah.
I've heard about a certain occultist who seems to have a great deal of cultural influence, Aleister Crowley, and a organization he was a part of called the Order of the Golden Dawn. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
I can tell you a little bit about that. I mean, Crowley was a member of the Golden Dawn, which was a very late 19th, early 20th century, basically esoteric fraternal order, essentially, that was about ritual magic. And I think that Crowley wanted to push things even further than the Golden Dawn, so he eventually left the Golden Dawn and formed this thing called the OTO.
A bunch of very, very bored rich people.
Yes, largely, but also in the case of Crowley, some pretty depraved people.
Right.
I mean, he was interested in pushing all kinds of social boundaries and things like that. And OTO is... is anyone in OTO in this room?
Be nice.
It's like a borderline sex cult, it seems to me. And I say that in the most loving way possible, right? but you know, it's... so yeah, Crowley is probably one of the most influential occultists of the 20th century. If not, I think, frankly, I think he's the most.
Yeah.
If you count Blavatsky as 19th century. So yeah, you can read all kinds of stuff about him. There's tons and tons of books. There's movies. He's a big deal. And he was
the
great beast. Yes, exactly. OTO is really interesting. You know, like I think that they're pretty fascinating actually, and they have lots and lots of the thing that's interesting about occultism in general is it's very syncretic in that it pulls things from everything. Like it's kind of like Pathfinder or D&D, where it's like, oh, this monster's cool, let's pull that in, and this thing's cool, and let's pull that in, and there's an attempt to sort of systematize all these different phenomena and stuff like that. And I'm not an expert on the OTO, but there are elements from Golden Dawn that they've incorporated into their practice. There's elements from like even like masonry and stuff like that it seems as though they've incorporated to some degree. It's a fascinating topic.
And those major figures are all fascinating, and I encourage you all to explore them. But really, the minor guys to me are much, much more interesting. I'm the biographer of this guy named Theodore H. White, who was a Baltimore occultist. And originally, I thought when we were planning this seminar, I was actually going to base a lot of it on T.H. White and say, let's see how he would work out in game terms, because this guy starts off as a snake oil salesman in Baltimore. Actually, he starts off as an oyster shucker. He's nobody. He falls into spiritualism when he marries his wife, because her family is spiritualist. They're doing table tipping and stuff. He begins selling snake oil. He opens a pharmacy at 1917 Pratt Street. You can visit that house. I actually did 3 weeks ago and got to meet the owners and let them know that, by the way, you used to have a cult in your house. He moves from...
How'd that go over?
Right, that was great. Yeah. He moves from snake oil into spiritualism. He sells magic mirrors for $700 a pair. Now, that's about $14,000 today.
A pair, was that a communication?
Well, no. Fun fact. So you put one mirror over your shoulder and then the other mirror in front of you, and you look at the reflection over your shoulder to see the spirits. So he would sell these things. Then he comes up with his grand scheme, which was the higher correspondence course in spiritualism, mesmerism, hypnotism, the black and white art, mental healing. I mean, it's a crazy long title. And he begins advertising, you know, hey, buy this book for only $15. The secrets of the world can be yours. You can make your old lovers come back to you. You can curse those who have wronged you. And I almost brought that. I'm sorry, it's a very, very fragile book, and I know Eric would have just folded the cover on it. So, but it is full of spells and hypnotism and mental, just this smorgasbord of isms, which are all the same isms we messed with in this book. And then he gets arrested for mail fraud, spends 3 years in prison for doing this. He gets out. Oh, he also manufactured talking boards, 4 different talking boards. He gets out. He moves to California where it's legal to do all this, and he does it all over again. When he was arrested in Baltimore, he had a net worth of over $3 million. In 1904. So the power of these guys, you don't have to be Aleister Crowley to reap the benefits. Yeah, and he had a harem of 21 17-year-old women who were all his typists, and yeah, that weren't allowed to leave the house. So he had his own cult.
If there's one thing I've learned from studying cults, is that at the center of every cult, there's at least one person having a lot of sex.
A lot of sex.
A lot. Yeah. Yes.
I've heard a lot about Western spiritualism and occultism, but I'm wondering about stuff like voodoo or maybe even Far East types of occultism. Will those be included in occult adventures?
To some degree. I mean, I think we want to be really careful, you know, not to like tread on current religious beliefs and stuff like that. Right. So for that reason, we don't do a lot with voodoo explicitly. Right.
Find the medium is a fantastic substitute for Loa writing.
Right. Exactly. And so we give you the tools to kind of do it yourself.
And
it's probably
mentioned in the
Another one that originally we were thinking about incorporating to some degree and ultimately decided not to, just because we wanted to be sensitive. There's a lot of Native American stuff that kind of is similar in themes to this, and we just decided, you know,
They don't need Pathfinder.
And Western occultism largely incorporates a lot of Eastern occultism, particularly the Theosophists.
Yeah, yeah.
So Eric was really there for
yes,
that.
Yes, very much so. So I would say that the best the vector through which that stuff comes through is actually a lot of the stuff I put in terms of, and I would say it's a little bit more weighted toward Hinduism, but Buddhism and Hinduism are very interlinked in many ways, and so you do get sort of some Eastern occultism through the lens of 19th century Western occultism.
The tools are there.
Very much so. I think so. Yeah, back here.
You did a occult book, Armory for Galarian.
Yeah.
How does things tie in, change, any edits back and forth between those?
I think I wrote up a section in Occult Mysteries, is the book you're talking about, on the Knights of the Iron Star, and there's the Knights of the Eastern Star and the Knights of the Western Star. There's a Knights of the Eastern Star archetype in this book.
Yep.
There's I would say that book was heavy on flavor, the Occult Mysteries. So I would say Occult Adventures gives you the rules framework to really flesh some of that stuff out in a maybe a little bit more authentic way. There's lots of like dark secrets and rituals and things like that that go hand in hand with that book. Here.
So out of both of your personal collections, what's the most interesting or your favorite or like the strangest thing you have?
That is an awesome question.
That's
I cannot
awesome
wait
question.
To hear Brandon's answer.
You go first.
Okay, for me, I know immediately. The guy I was talking about earlier, C.W. Leadbeater, he, along with a woman named Annie Besant, who was sort of Blavatsky's successor in the Theosophical Society, did a series of past life regression things in their monthly magazine, Theosophist, that eventually, around the early 1920s, resulted in them declaring that this child that they ran into on the beach in their India headquarters, his aura was so resplendent that he must be the reincarnation of Christ.
He was Anakin.
His midichlorians were even higher than Master Yoda's, essentially. And it's a guy named Krishnamurti. You may have heard of him. But he... In these past life regression sessions that they started, they were called like Through the Veil or something like that. And then eventually they became called The Lies of Alcyone. Alcyone is a star. And they would give, that was Krishnamurti, this world teacher, this reincarnation basically of Jesus, was going to come. And they're saying this coming world teacher. And the whole Theosophical movement basically changed into this messianic movement for this little kid that I'm pretty sure Leadbeater just thought was cute without a shirt, you know, when he saw him on the beach. So it's a little sordid. A lot sorted, but these things are basically like, okay, Brandon, in this month's issue, we're going to do your life in ancient Babylon, or your life in ancient Atlantis, or your life in ancient Lemuria, or whatever. And the funny thing is, we're going to call Brandon Orion, right, because that's a star, and we're going to call you Beetlejuice, right? And so we can use the same names to tell stories about how you two are interrelated throughout your whole lives, and eventually, or all of your lives. And eventually what would happen is the Theosophists would pay money to get their own star name to be incorporated into these charts, and they started measuring their social value by how closely related they were to this kid, Krishnamurti. The most prized thing I have is the books that are called The Lies of Alcyone, which collect all these articles, and then a few other follow-up volumes called The Lives, Progress to Reincarnation, I think, which are different characters, and it's just fascinating, and they read like fantasy. You know, they're like fighting monsters and, you know, cyclopes and things like that, and you got ancient Lemuria, and it's like that just makes my nerdgasm thing happen big time. And but one of my favorite things is because although I'm very, very interested in occultism and esotericism and stuff like that, I'm not a religious person at all, right? Like, so the great thing is the Theosophical Society was pumped and primed to introduce this new world teacher, but the kid, as he developed into an adult, was not really that into it. And so ultimately, his great message that this religious order was pushing toward over the course of about 50, 70 years, if you go back to the beginning, he was basically like, avoid dogma, religion is kind of bullshit, do your own thing. And it was a very sort of humanist, very sort of 20th century message that came out of that. And I kind of love the idea that the ultimate message of this quasi-religious movement was essentially a secular message.
Conveyed with sad trombones.
Yeah. 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 Essentially. Yeah. I mean, that's essentially it, right?
And like, you don't necessarily need all these books and everything. It's like, it boils down to this inherent truth of just don't be a dick. It's like Newton's law, you know? And so The Lives of Alcyone is my favorite thing that I have. How about you, Brendan?
I'm proud to be the caretaker of an item known as the Dr. Hare Spiritoscope. Dr. Robert Hare was the Victorian equivalent of maybe Neil deGrasse Tyson. He was a chemist. Back then, chemistry was king, and he was our nation's top chemist, probably the world's top chemist. He invented all sorts of crazy things like the oxygen-hydrogen blowtorch and things that are still pieces of lab equipment today. And a very highly regarded, very kind of a pop culture go-to science guy in the 1830s and 40s. And he retires in the 1850s, donates all his stuff to the Smithsonian Institute, where his collection constituted the first expanded wing of Smithsonian Castle. So he was a big, larger-than-life American figure. And he sets out to put his scientific acumen to debunking spiritualism. And he creates these test devices he called spiritoscopes, these cast iron dials that were these blind test devices that you would roll back and forth and spell out messages and numbers and such. And the results he got actually convinced him that he was receiving accurate spirit communications. And saddle up. And so he flip-flopped, and he publishes this book called Spiritualism Scientifically Demonstrated, and comes out, again, this would be the equivalent of Stephen Hawking coming on TV and saying, actually, I discovered heaven is real, we can talk to the dead, and clean up your act, because they're listening, and we're talking back. And I own one of the only known surviving item. It is the world's oldest known spirit communication device by a good decade. Or modern American spiritualism communication.
And unfortunately, we're going to have to wrap it up there. That's the end of the session. We are about to start another session on occult adventures. So there apparently is a line outside, so we want to let those people get a chance to come in. Please do come back in yourselves. If you have questions, hold them, and we'll. Brandon and I are on the next panel as well. We'd be happy to answer them.
No Directions PaizoCon 2015 coverage is made possible by the KDCon team. Thanks go out to Rich Flynn, Sarah Bull, Darren Caldemeyer, and Alexander Agunis. For more great Pathfinder audio coverage, check out NoDirectionPodcast.com.